Today at Reader's Corner, Scott W. Berg, author of 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End.
August of 1862, when the Dakota War erupts, it's no exaggeration to say that this is the lowest moment in the history of the Union. And when this war erupts, it's not all 10,000 Dakota who rise up. It's actually only a few hundred, mostly very young men, probably in their teens and low 20s. There's many sort of objectives in this war. Little Crow's objective seems to have been to revisit some treaties. Some of the young men just want vengeance. And in the end, it becomes one of the major decisions of Lincoln's presidency. He had to decide the fate of 300-plus Dakota Indians all at once.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The Dakota War of 1862 and its aftermath would likely be among the most remembered stories of American frontier expansion in the 19th century, if not for one thing, the American Civil War, which was being fought at the same time. As a result, the extraordinary story of the rebellion by Little Crow and his Dakota followers is largely overshadowed in history books and the American psyche by accounts of the brutal bloodletting on eastern battlefields called Antietam, Fredericksburg, and Gettysburg. In his book 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End, Scott W. Berg tells the compelling tale of the Dakota War and its complex ties to the much larger struggle between the states. Now out in paperback, 38 Nooses also details the fascinating story of Abraham Lincoln and his personal and surprisingly deep involvement in the judgment of more than 300 men condemned for their role in the Indian uprising. The result was the simultaneous hanging of 38 Dakota men in the largest government-sanctioned execution in American history, and thus the title of the book. Born and raised in Minnesota's Twin Cities, Mr. Berg teaches nonfiction writing and literature at George Mason University. He is a regular contributor to the Washington Post and other publications on topics as diverse as civil rights history, classical theater, the sport of cricket, and the digitization of history. Mr. Berg joins us by phone for the interview. Scott Berg, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Well, you know, I used to live in Springfield, Illinois. I probably have taken more people through Lincoln's home and down to New Salem than I ever want to remember. And in all the years that I read and studied Lincoln, and I have not visited the new museum, which I hear is really something to see, I never really associated Lincoln's presidency much with the Indian Wars. The focus was always on the Civil War. So in one sense, one of the most important results of your book was to bring us to a better understanding of the fact that Lincoln was almost fighting wars on two fronts.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, I was born and raised in the Twin Cities, and we didn't hear much about this. I mean, this is the formative event of the state. It occurs only 4 years after statehood, and you know, they were still grappling out of territorial status, and then this event occurs, which, by the way, you summarized wonderfully. And if we studied it in elementary school or junior high or high school, I don't remember it. There are probably a lot of complex reasons for that, but if we didn't study it in Minnesota, it's no surprise I don't find it sort of being studied all over. But it really is sort of this spark of what becomes the Indian Wars of the Northwest. And you're right, Lincoln is, and his cabinet, frankly, are fairly deeply involved in this. Among their multitude of concerns, this is something they have to take very, very seriously. And they do. They're a little slow to take it seriously, but they end up taking it seriously. And in the end, it becomes one of the major decisions of Lincoln's presidency. It's the greatest number of men. He had to decide the fate, as you mentioned, of 300-plus Dakota Indians. All at once, which is about as many sort of individual destinies as a president has ever had to decide in one moment.
Well, to your point about what's lost in history, one of the things I did notice about reading your book is that there were a number of references you made to if only we knew more of how this turned out, or if only we knew more of the details. There really are some gaps here in what we know, which could be accountable in part to the fact that there wasn't quite the same kind of recording of the Indian side of things as you might get from the white man's side of things.
Oh, absolutely. And that's true in anyone undertaking sort of the scholarship of Native American history, whether the scholar is a Native American, him or herself or not. There's quite a treasure trove, of course, of oral history. There's a fair amount of sort of primary documentation, but all of that documentation, of course, is in the form of, say, interviews with prominent Dakota leaders done with, say, newspaper editors or reporters, or a soldier who lived among the Dakota may have kept a diary and may have, in fact, there's several soldiers who did that and sort of befriended some of the Dakota in order, but you're still operating with language differences, and we can never sort of take at face value what a newspaper in 1860 or 61 publishes the results of an interview. It's very interesting. Many of the people would even, in fact, take these stories from the Dakota and very much sort of in a Henry Wadsworth Longfellow sort of style, you know, try to transform these stories into a form of high poetry in which you're essentially losing not only the cadence of the Dakota telling of the story, but you're really losing many of the particulars, and it's being framed in a different way. And so that is one of the challenges with a story like this. There's many different people who have told pieces of this story, of the Dakota War, and each one is sort of delving into a different set of primary sources, and some of those sources are oral histories, and it's a story that can be told many different ways, depending on where you're looking.
Were you able to visit just a handful of libraries or collections of materials, or did you actually have to go on the road through the Dakotas to get the background for this story?
Well, county historical societies across the Dakotas and in Minnesota are very helpful. Dakota elders, very helpful. There was a diaspora of the Dakota people immediately following both forced and quasi-voluntary after this. But quite a few Dakota returned to the area over the next 10, 15, 40 years. And so there were, you know, elders and historians to speak to there, Minnesota Historical Society, Wisconsin Historical Society, the National Archives. And there is a fairly large paper trail, again, mostly on the white side of the story. But it's more varied than you might think. And in the end, though, I mean, I think, and many people who write sort of narrative history probably feel this way. You know, the first thing I did was went and walked as many of the sites as I could. This happens, most of the action happens in the Minnesota River Valley, which is a major river in Minnesota, but a tributary of the Mississippi. And driving up and down that, and some of this territory is still sparsely populated, and the chance to walk these lakes and these trails and stand on top of a ridge and look across to what used to be, say, Dakota territory, then was farmland. Once your feet are on the ground, once you're visiting the sites, once you're visiting the places, I think you get that's when you start to really get in tune with the tale and let your imagination and your sort of observation do the work there.
You know, this business of how we sometimes forget where we've come from. I was having dinner a couple of weeks ago with a former president of the university, and he and his wife were explaining that their daughter moved to Devil's Lake, North Dakota. And I had not read the section of your book where you talk about the role that Devil's Lake played. I think Little Crow wound up in Devil's Lake.
Many thousands of Dakota were captured after Little Crow, who was the ostensible leader of the uprising, although that it was a complicated leadership structure, but he was sort of at least the public face of Dakota resistance to white encroachment. He escapes and he heads off into what was then the Dakota Territory, in the very near the Canadian border, a place called Devil's Lake, which is just sort of a really unique body of water in that it's called a basin lake, and there are no rivers feed it. It only rises and lowers according to rain and evaporation, and it's not fed by rivers, and so it's a very unusual sort of body of water. It can rise as much as 40 feet in a few seasons because of that. An amazing sort of place full of spirits. And this was a sort of a gathering place for many of not only the Eastern Dakota, which Little Crow belonged to, but the Western Dakota and even some of the tribes out where you are.
The only thing we knew it for was its walleye fishing. That's the point I'm making. Is, you know, excuse me, but we kind of missed the history here, and now you're filling us in, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing. I mean, we have an image of Native American history, and especially relates to the Indian Wars. It sort of has us, you know, sort of out on the plains where the buffalo roam, and Lakota on horseback, or, you know, if you go further south, the Comanche on horseback, and these pitched battles. Well, the Dakota, the eastern Dakota of this, you know, this book of Little Crow's bands and tribes, they were a woodlands people. You know, instead of horses, think canoes. Instead of buffalo, think ducks and other game, right? And, you know, the rivers were their highways, not the great open plains. And that sort of sense that when you walk into the woods in Minnesota or Wisconsin, that you are involved in a history that was, that's largely been sort of covered up by their current sort of status as wonderful tourist destinations. And you know, the Dakota Territory is the same way. It's not all the Black Hills. There's a lot of this history happens all over the Dakota
right.
Territory.
Like the Ojibwa, I would assume, of the Northwoods.
It's interesting. Minnesota has three sort of zones, both climate and vegetative zones. And the Dakota live where the woods meet the prairie, where the deciduous woods meet the prairie, and along the Minnesota River, and so they're sort of half and half. You know, in the summer they might go out onto the plains, but then they live in the sort of deciduous. Up north in Minnesota, Wisconsin, you have those wonderful, wonderful coniferous forests with all the birch wood and all the rivers cut out of the retreating glaciers. And that's the Ojibwe territory, and that is, you know, sort of in between the Ojibwe and the Dakota. You have a zone of contact for hundreds and hundreds of years. The Dakota and Ojibwe have been either at war or in a form of war, or in many cases at peace and trading with each other. What's interesting about this story is that the Ojibwe land was much less suited for farming at this time. It's so, you know, some of it is, but the Dakota land was that prime, rich, black earth that, you know, you could plant anything in and it would grow. And so the Dakota Territory, the treaties with the Dakota that lead eventually to the Dakota War, happened much earlier than with the Ojibwe, because the Dakota have the land that's just, you know, as Minnesota and the Dakota Territory and Wisconsin are booming in population, where are they looking? Where can we farm? Oh, we can farm over there, but who's there? The Dakota. And so that leads, you know, down what unfortunately seems to be an inexorable path toward this kind of conflict.
You're listening to Scott W. Berg, author of 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. So I think we all know from history the story of these treaties that Washington would enter into with various tribes, and oftentimes they were broken. But help us describe the government policies in general that leads up to the rebellion of the Dakota. What gives the Dakota the reason for this rebellion?
Well, it's very complicated. It has to do with land, and it has to do with change. It has to do with the fact that, you know, millions and millions of acres of Minnesota are not necessarily claimed by the Dakota. It's not as if they, you know, drew boundaries around it and said, this is our land, we have a title to this, but rather was homeland, was their accustomed place to be. They were a seasonal people. They would move with the seasons, and they would have one season they'd be on the river, and one season they'd be, you know, on the prairie. And through a succession of treaties, that land gets shrunk and shrunk and shrunk from millions of acres down to just a few hundred on the south side of a single river. And it's the same old story. I mean, it can be discouraging, and it is discouraging to see sort of how this gets repeated around the country in both the East and the West. But if the government could find sort of any Dakota leaders willing to sign a treaty, they'd say, okay, good, we've got your signature, let's go. And that didn't necessarily mean that all the Dakota, A, had signed on to this treaty, or B, were even aware of it. I mean, imagine you yourself living in a house somewhere, and somebody shows up at your door and says, somebody you don't know very well and who you've never accepted as having any say in matters relating to you has signed a treaty somewhere far off, and in a few weeks here you need to be out of your house and go over there. And that sort of repeated over and over and over again creates a real loss of culture, creates a real sense of sort of building frustration and anger and degradation, frankly. And when this war erupts, it's not all 10,000 Dakota in Minnesota and Dakota Territory who rise up. It's actually only a few hundred. And as happens over and over again, these are mostly very young men, probably in their teens and low 20s, who have lost their ability to plug into cultural systems and the process of becoming a warrior that had existed for hundreds of years. And they've essentially seen the choices that all of their ancestors had closed off to them. and their anger is looking for a flashpoint. And as happens so often, there's an incident in a small town where it's not very well recorded, where a very small group of Indian Dakota warriors out hunting and they ask for food at a farmhouse, and it ends up with five settlers dead and these four Dakota stealing a wagon and driving back to their villages. And out of that little incident, sort of these young men make the decision, now is the time. Now is the time we're going to rise up. And then they look to Little Crow to be their leader for that. And it's very often 50, 100, 200 years of building resentments that find a flashpoint that very often doesn't seem commensurate with the level of the violence that happens. Then you think, well, this is a small incident. Why does a war start out of that? Because all this has been building under the surface.
So what was the level of the violence by the time it was all over? How many dead? How many wounded, injured?
Well, this was it's interesting. From the white point of view, this war has been known by many names. The Dakota War, U.S. Dakota War, the Little Crows War. But many settlers on the prairie for years called it the Minnesota Massacre. And the reason for that is that there's many sort of objectives in this war. Little Crow's objective seems to have been to put enough pressure on white authorities to sort of revisit some treaties and get better terms, perhaps get land. From history's viewpoint, that's a pipe dream, but some of the young men just want vengeance, and they want revenge. And so the war begins where a very small group of Dakota warriors move out into the territories and kill settlers and kill families of settlers. And it's in about 500 to 800, depending on how you look at the records, about 500 to 800 settlers, white settlers are killed, farmers mostly, but townspeople, merchants, traders, are killed within the first few weeks of this of the war. Then the war sort of moves into a more quasi-military sort of form, with Little Crow leading groups of Dakota warriors against white soldiers. And in that part of it, 100, 200 white soldiers die. You know, as it happens in many of these stories, the immediate prosecution of the war seems to be an enormous success for the Dakota. Maybe a few dozen Dakota at most die during the entire what we call the Dakota War. It's, of course, what happens after the Dakota War where the real tragedy for the Dakota occurs. And so during the war, there's this very lopsided body count, both settlers killed and soldiers killed. After the war, the story changes quite a bit.
And before we get to that, let's jump back to Washington, D.C. It's 1862. In the meantime, what's going on in Lincoln's life and the life of the nation?
Well, first of all, one of the startling things in researching any president is how enormously busy they were. Literally in a single day, 100 or 200 individual matters can come across their desk. So first of all, he's just overwhelmed and yet somehow sort of keeping it together. August of 1862, when the Dakota War erupts, it's no exaggeration to say that this is the lowest moment of the Civil War for the Union, obviously very different from the Confederate perspective, but for the Union, it's the lowest moment of the war. And by extension, it's no exaggeration to say, therefore, it's the lowest moment in the history of the Union. Robert E. Lee is advancing from Richmond. Lincoln can't find a general who seems to be able to do anything about Robert E. Lee. They're moving up. They're at Manassas, and if you know the geography of Virginia, Manassas. I live just outside of D.C.
Right.
And I can be in Manassas in 15 minutes. And they're in Manassas, and there's a very real, palpable sense within the capital, Washington D.C., that Lincoln will be sitting down with Robert E. Lee any day now to sort of lay out what the new split up country is going to look like. We know what happened in the end, so we tend to think, well, it was always going to work out somehow. But this was the low moment, and there was a lot of sort of anxiety and frustration and despair about that. And so that's what's happening with Lincoln. He's trying to figure out, to really boil it down, he's trying to figure out who can he find. What can he do to stop Robert E. Lee, who sort of emerged in this brilliant campaign in Virginia over the summer of 1862? Well, they get a telegram from the Northwest, and it was called the Northwest then. I don't know what Idaho would have been called, because Minnesota was considered
right
out there.
Yeah.
And from the Northwest, a telegram arrived saying the Indians have risen and are murdering settlers. And they get telegrams like this fairly often, because anytime there's an Indian raid, or anytime there's a skirmish with soldiers, they get kind of this kind of telegram. So at first they think, well, just handle it. And then they get more telegrams and more telegrams until they sort of understand something major, something significant is happening. Their reaction is interesting. The first thing that Washington assumes is that the tribes of the Northwest are being agitated by Confederate agents. They assume that the Southern agents are up there supporting, funding, supplying these Indian tribes in order to distract Lincoln and the Union from the business of fighting the war further to the east. That's not the case at all. But that's how it sort of comes to them, sort of as an imagined or assumed, I guess would be a better word, an assumed Confederate conspiracy to create another front in the war that's already going badly.
You're listening to Scott W. Berg. He's the author of 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. So eventually, these folks, these Native Americans who are identified, who are involved in this, these young men and perhaps some older, and then eventually that gets to Washington, and Lincoln has to make a decision. Take us through how he gets involved and what eventually, of course, he decides to do about this.
The war part of this, the conflict part, is never really in doubt, simply because of the vastly superior numbers that at first the states can bring to bear. And it very soon, you know, the U.S. Army, the Union regiments become involved. Because of those numbers and because of the firepower, the outcome's never all that much in doubt. The question is, can Little Crow get terms? Can he not? Well, the war ends 6 weeks after it begins. And then the process of sort of some Dakota flee. There's a very, very ambiguous questions of the rules of war in terms of the use of white flags, terms of surrender, false enticements to bring in Dakota. So there's a whole set of ambiguous questions there. But in the end, thousands of Dakota are captured, families and soldiers. And by the way, many thousands of Dakota who had been part of what was called a peace party against the war effort among the Dakota. It's hardly as if the Dakota were unified here. And then a series of trials begins to take place under this essentially the same military commission rules that come all the way down to us today in Guantanamo Bay. They have been altered, of course, over the years, but this is really only after the Mexican-American War. This is only the second real significant use of the military commission in American military history. These trials take place, and at first the trials go at a sort of a, at least a somewhat understandable pace. But by the end of these trials, they're trying 40 Dakota in a day, sometimes bringing them in chained together, six at a time. Individual trials might take less, 5 minutes. And the entire sort of criteria for declaring a Dakota guilty was if anyone could say they saw them at a battle. Okay, I saw him at a battle, therefore. All kinds of questions about the rules and articles of war come up about this. But at the time, winter was coming on, and nobody had any interest in being subtle about this. And so in the end, 303 Dakota are sentenced to be hanged, and sentenced to be hanged all in one hanging. It would have been sort of done in, one after one group of 40 after the other hanging. It's at that point that the folks in Minnesota sort of are either made aware of or figure out for themselves that these kinds of sentences require executive approval, because this is almost ad hoc the way these military commissions were put together in this year. So what happens is those trial transcripts come to Washington, and all of the whites and all the white generals in Minnesota are saying, okay, here's our trial transcripts. Now please approve these. We want to get on with these hangings. But Lincoln says, stop. Lincoln says, I want to look at these. I want to have my lawyers look at these. I want to have John Palmer Usher, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior, and some of my most trusted lawyers look at these. Not because Lincoln was necessarily compassionate here, although he was obviously a very compassionate man, but because he had serious doubts about the legal process by which many of the Dakota had been convicted. And so there's a week or two or three where his lawyers very carefully go through the records. And in the end, using Lincoln's standards for guilt or innocence, they arrive at a conclusion that 39 Dakota Indians have committed capital offenses and should be hanged. And the rest were sort of, the execution was stayed, but no final decision was made. In the end, one more stay of execution was granted, and so they become 38. Lincoln, in the end, sits at his desk, and he pens the names of the 38 Dakota Indians to be hung in his own hand, and that document still exists today, and that's the document that was used as the basis of the hanging of 38 Dakota Indians on December 26, 1862.
So you have 264 who are stayed and 38 who are hung with Lincoln's approval. How does Lincoln come off on this when it's all said and done? How, you know, I was thinking about that moral compass that everybody talks about. Are we using a 19th century moral compass or a 21st century moral compass and trying to figure out where Lincoln comes off on this?
That's the question. And Lincoln occupies what's happening in Washington. Lincoln occupies about a quarter of the book, and I leave readers to make their own decision, but this 38 News is just a couple days ago came out in paperback, so it's a brand new paper. So I've been, you know, I've been speaking on this and talking to people and for almost a year now since it came out in hardcover, and what's very interesting is the kind of Rorschach test this is for what you feel about Lincoln. Let's start with the Dakota descendants. Let's start with those who can trace their, you know, bloodlines directly back to the participants, either on the side of peace or on the side of war in this. If you start with the Dakota, there's not a lot of celebration of Lincoln's decision. This is not a case where Lincoln becomes a hero to many people. A lot of Dakota, although there's not unanimous agreement, of course, but would feel that, in fact, this was a sovereign nation rising up against the folks that had taken their land and were, you know, created this degradation for them, and feel that Lincoln is, if not a villain, certainly not deserving of praise for this. There's a whole other group of people that would look at this and say, if not for Lincoln, 303 Dakota hang. What's interesting about this is that when Lincoln announces that he's going to review the sentences, the uproar in Minnesota and Wisconsin, the Dakota Territory and Iowa, is loud and constant. I mean, some of the editorials are written and are just really, really hard to read. It's not an exaggeration to say that newspaper editors are saying, you know, kill them all, hang them now, Lincoln, don't you dare, you know, stop these executions. And I mean, literally writing, you know, in to Lincoln in these editorials. And what's interesting is then when the decision to stay all but 39 and then later 38 of the executions is announced, there's this brief spasm of anger at that decision in Minnesota. But then it settles down. And I don't want to be flip about this, but there's a sense that, well, we didn't get to hang everybody, but we got our hanging. And so it's interesting on the prairie how that reads. Today, honestly, you can stare at it for months and years and still not sort of come to a final decision on whether those 38 hangings were justified given the way the trials took place and given. And so, honestly, I think that you bring to Lincoln's decision your preconceptions about Lincoln himself. And I do wonder how those, say, in the South who might view Lincoln in a little bit differently, especially those with ties to the Civil War, how they might read a decision like this. I don't think there's a single conclusion we can come to. For some people, he's a hero for doing this. For other people, there's nothing heroic about, you know, the largest mass execution in American history.
Well, Scott, we've run out of time for today's show, but we haven't had a chance yet to talk about some of the fascinating personalities you bring into your story. What I'd like to do is continue our conversation on next week's program.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
Next week, part two of our interview with Scott W. Berg, author of 38 Nooses, Lincoln, Little Crow, and the Beginning of the Frontier's End. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.